I got to be good at marketing and negotiation. I market the fine good deals, negotiate them into great deals, get them under contract, and then sell my position in that contract. And being that I was broke 15 years ago, that changed everything for me.
Welcome to the Rental Property Owner and Real Estate Investor Podcast, brought to you by the Rental Property Owner Association, providing benefits and services to real estate investors and rental property owners for over 48 years. With your host, Ryan Hamrick from Hamrick Investment Group.
Hello and welcome to episode 45. My guest today has helped hundreds of average people replace their income, quit their jobs, and turn full-time to real estate investing. Tom Zeeb is an active investor and president of Traction Real Estate Investors Association and founder of Traction Real Estate Mentors. He's also going to be speaking at the Rental Property Owners Association's free conference and expo on Friday, February 24th, 2017 at 1 p.m. So if you're in the West Michigan area, or even if you're in Detroit or Chicago or anywhere near the Grand Rapids area, this is definitely an event you don't want to miss. To find out more information and to get your free passes, you can go to rpoaonline.org. Tom, I'm looking forward to seeing you there, and I'm excited to be talking with you today.
Thanks, Brian. Likewise. Thanks for having me.
So your topic at the conference is going to be rapid cash generation, how to quickly make money without money in real estate. And I definitely want to get into that. But before we do, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into real estate investing?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me tell you a story about when I first started. I was stuck in a 9-to-5 job that I didn't particularly love. And I thought I would go out and buy a rental property and become rich really fast, right? Basically, I'd read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which got me all excited, but I had no idea of what to do. And the first thing I bought was a 6-unit building in New York City, and it darn near took me under because I had professional tenants. All of them knew exactly how to play me. The place was falling apart. I had run out of funding to keep it going, and I found myself in a really, really bad spot, in a bad pinch. I had to go out and get a new job. I had to get a temp job to make ends meet and hold everything together until I discovered what I'm going to be teaching at the conference, and that's real estate wholesaling. So quickly turning properties, flipping contracts for extra cash because I wasn't ready to be a rental property owner yet. And I had kind of overstepped where I was at. And I put this system together to help other people not fall into that same trap. One, or two, if you already are a landlord, you are a rental property owner, then oftentimes we find a need for cash. Because, you know, fast forward 15 years, I own multiple rental properties now. I love having that passive income. It's awesome. But things come up now and then, right? Roofs leak, tenants skip town, things go wrong. And it's good to know that I can go flip a different kind of real estate property and make the money to sustain my rentals, because that's where my long-term wealth is coming from.
Let's talk about your rentals that you do own. You started with a 6-unit in New York City. You had some issues there. Did you end up buying some more properties as well?
Eventually, yes. I had to ditch the 6-unit early on. And then I spent a number of years simply flipping properties. So finding good deals for either landlords or rehabbers, putting them under contract, and then assigning the contract to the ultimate end buyer, to that rehabber or to that landlord, and stepping completely out of the picture, but making $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 in the process of selling them my position in the deal. Because, Brian, what I realized was I got to be good at marketing and negotiation, right? So I market the fine good deals, I would negotiate them into great deals, get them under contract, and then sell my position in that contract. And being that I was broke 15 years ago, that made a big difference. That changed everything for me. And then that's what allowed me to get into a position, a stronger position, to be able to buy and hold and deal with the ups and downs that occur from time to time, as we all know, when you're a rental property owner.
So 15 years ago, you were broke, and you came across this as a way to make some quick money. How did that change things for you?
Oh, it changed everything. When eventually the place I was working for in the temporary day job, they got rid of all the temps. There was a change at the top, and they cleared all the temps out, and I was left without a job. but it didn't matter anymore because at that point I had done a couple of deals. I was sure of what I was doing. My marketing was out there. The phone was ringing. I knew more deals were coming. I was actually relieved to be able to, let's say, quit early. I was planning to quit, but it hadn't happened yet. And then I just took the plunge and never went back at that point because I knew as long as I keep marketing, I will get good leads. I will convert using my negotiation skills, convert those good leads into really red hot deals, put them under contract and sell them to other investors. And after a couple of years of that, I had good money down. I was confident in what I was doing as a real estate investor, and I was able to turn back towards what my original plan was, and that was buying and holding rentals.
So you were using the real estate wholesaling and flipping to kind of finance, well, first of all, pay your bills once you lost your job, but then at the same time funneling some of that money back into some buy and hold type investments.
Absolutely. It kept me stable financially, paid all the bills, kept the lights on, allowed a fabulous lifestyle. And I was able to start buying the types of properties I always wanted to buy, to hold, to be able to rent, to do exactly what rental property owners do. And that's collect rents over time, let someone else pay down the mortgage, and create the equity from the mortgage pay down and from the appreciation of the property.
A great way to go. Now, were you living in New York City at the time?
No, I was not. That was what was extra stupid about it. I was living in Washington, D.C. I still live in Washington, D.C. I'm originally from Buffalo, New York, but I've been in D.C. for 18, 19 years now.
Okay. So where was the wholesaling that you were doing? What area were you doing this in?
I started doing that in Northern Virginia, which is kind of, let's say, the outer suburbs of Washington, D.C. Just the way we are around here, being a tri-state area, the city of, picture Detroit being its own state, and then suburban Detroit being in a different state. That's effectively the way it is here. So I went out into the very bread and butter neighborhoods of Virginia and focused on older rundown houses in neighborhoods that had struggled for quite a few years. But as things turned around a little bit, the rising tide was lifting those areas up, and certainly appreciation had taken place. And these rundown, dilapidated houses now became basically diamonds in the rough. And so I would look for the diamonds in the rough, get the diamond in the rough under contract, and assign my contract for that diamond in the rough to a landlord or a rehabber.
Well, let's go back to how you came across the idea to even do this in the first place, because you started as a buy and hold investor buying a 6-unit in New York City. What made you think, well, maybe I can raise some quick cash by real estate wholesaling?
Well, it actually, if only I could take credit for that thought. It happened by accident. I had the first deal under contract. It looked good. I was confident in my numbers, and I decided to advertise it as a handyman special to see what would happen. To almost prove to myself that the numbers were good and I was safe moving forward. And I had quite a number of investors interested in buying it from me. And I hadn't really thought about it that way before. And when the guy I sold it to said, well, he wound up, he told me what price he would buy it from me at, and that was about $22,700 more than I had it under contract for. So I think it was $22,738 was my first wholesale check. And I went, wow, considering the beating I had already taken. $22,738. It was huge, just shy of $23,000 from having been broke and struggling and stuck in the temp job and having everything had gone wrong. Suddenly things were going right. And I thought, well, heck, I'm not even sure exactly what I just did, but I would love to do it again. And so I would talk to the attorneys about it and figure out what was going on. And then, oh, well, this has a name. It's called wholesaling. I can do this on a regular basis. I can focus on this and make things happen. And that's exactly what I did.
So you kind of stumbled across this this technique, this real estate wholesaling, figured out what it actually was, around the time you were actually doing it. How did that change your direction at that point?
Well, it gave me the funds to be able to stabilize my life, stabilize my personal finances, market aggressively more for deals. I mean, that's one of the things I'm always teaching people is you have to take some of what you make and reinvest it back into your business. You can't go blow it all, because then you're right back at square one. You have to, if you're constantly reinvesting in your business, reinvesting namely in marketing, you'll keep generating more and more deals, and then you get the, you know, the proverbial snowball effect that your business just keeps growing. And that, so that's what I did. That was different. I was able to reinvest my business, spend more on direct mail, on newspaper ads, on even having the time to go out there and network and develop the connections and relationships I needed to have people feeding me deals. And then I've just kept doing one deal after another. And then, it put me in a special place, because I was able to go, all right, I can wholesale this and make a good amount of money. Or what if I rehab this myself and make even more? Or what if I buy and hold this and make good money over time? Because that's going to be a great rental area. So it opened up all the other exit strategies to me. Because when I was broke, I didn't really have the other exit strategies available. They weren't safe. They weren't smart. They weren't wise. But once there was good income coming in from wholesaling real estate, I realized, okay, now I can do the other strategies. Now I can finally build the buy and hold portfolio that I've always wanted to have.
So that really opened up some options for you once you stumbled across that way of making money.
Absolutely. That's why I kind of, and the one of the reasons I didn't get it, Brian, was the word wholesaling doesn't really make any sense in real estate. So I like to call it rapid cash generation, because that's what it does for me, and that's what it'll do for you. It generates cash rapidly. So the term wholesaling to me is a little nebulous, crazy, out there, doesn't mean much, but rapid cash generation is the name of the game.
Rapid cash generation. And let's talk about that. I mean, how rapid is the cash generation from when, you know, the period from when you put out your direct mail to when you get some calls to when you're actually able to get something under contract to when you actually flip that contract to someone else? What's the timetable there?
All told, I'm usually looking around 60 days. So the last 30 of those is taken up from the moment I signed the contract to getting it through to settlement. Because there's usually, you know, I write my contracts for 30 days, you do the title work, and all the legal process eats up that last 30 days. The first 30 days, it's getting the marketing out there. So, you know, if you think about it, if you go do a big postcard mailing or a letter mailing, there's a few days lead time for the post office to deliver those. But once they get delivered and people start calling, they start emailing, they start filling out forms on my website, and then I can start the conversation with them, which is something I'm going to talk about in February, is how do you start and maintain that conversation with them? Because that's the beginning of good negotiation, is getting that conversation going. And then from that conversation, where are they at on price at the beginning? And where do I need to move them to in price to make it into a great deal? And that's what I spend the first 30 days doing.
And do you have that initial process kind of automated? It sounds like people are able to go online and fill out forms. I mean, how does that work?
Yes. I mean, I'm happy to have people call, and they call in, or they can go online to the website. Remember, your website's a 24-hour storefront. So it's a 24-hour marketing piece, honestly, when you build it right. And they can be looking at my website, getting information, answering the questions in their head, and building confidence in me so that they pick up the phone and call, or go ahead and fill out the form on the website, which comes right into my email. And then I know I can look at it quickly and determine, all right, how fast do I need to call this person back? Does this look like, I mean, you can smell them after a while. Does this look like a good deal, or is this not so much? Because it's a numbers game. One out of every 30 to 35 leads or so for me is a good deal.
And I know that you're going to talk at the conference about the conversation that you have and how that negotiation goes. But can you tell us a little bit about the negotiation process and how it works for you?
Sure. This is the part, Brian, where I found that I really separated myself from everybody else. Because a lot of people are flat out afraid of negotiation. They're intimidated by it, or they just flat out don't like it because they don't recognize the negotiation for what it is. And it doesn't have to be frightening and intimidating. It's simply, you know, getting to the bottom line with the other person. And literally, it sounds cheesy to say create a win-win situation, But it is. You want to find out about that seller's motivations. Why are they motivated? How motivated are they? Why do they need to sell? When do they need to sell by? And you ask those questions so that you can best present an offer that works for them. And when you study the techniques that I'll be teaching you, you realize it's not difficult. It's a dance. You move one way, the person moves with you. You move the other way, they still stay with you. So you want to keep dancing back and forth with them because that's getting their price down. And so talk about how to frame out the negotiation. So you have a target price, you have their starting price, and the different techniques that you use to move them down, because there's a lot of different things in negotiation that people don't know. Most people out there don't know it because they don't teach it in school. And the only time we think negotiation, we think used car salesman. And that's not, no wonder nobody likes it, because that's not the image you really want to have in your head. So when you implement these techniques, and they're easy once you learn them, when you learn what the technique is and then you practice it, you'd be amazed at how fast you can get prices dropping and prices moving towards the price that you need to buy at.
Yeah, a lot of negotiation in real estate especially is problem solving. You know, if the seller needs to get a certain price, that's probably because there's some issue or problem that they need to solve. I'm wondering if you have any examples of like a creative negotiation that you went through where you had to solve some pretty tough obstacles and problems, but were able to come through it successfully.
Oh, absolutely. Let me give you a good example. I'll tell you a story about one of my rapid cash generation students. Her name is Neva. And when she marketed to a specific area that had a lot of single family houses and condo buildings, and she got a lead on a condo. And when she asked the guy, "Why are you selling?" Okay, which I always want to ask that question, because then you understand their motivation and how they found you. And he said, "Well, I get a few of these flyers in the mail every month, but I never see the same names twice. But I got a second postcard from you, so I know you're for real. I know that you're in business." So first off, the repetition in the marketing was what set her apart from the crowd. Then the reason why he was selling is not normally something that on the surface of it would appear to be very motivating. But when we dug deeper, we understood why. And so he said, "Why are you selling?" And this man said, "Well, I'm retiring next month, and I want to play golf all throughout my retirement for the rest of my life because I feel like I've earned it." And he goes, "This is a rental property. I want to sell it because I realize what you're offering me now is basically 15 years worth of profits." He goes, "If I wait around 15 years, I'll get the same amount of money, but you're offering that to me as a gob of cash right now." And he goes, "I don't want to sound morbid on this, but I hope I live that long, but I'm finally retired. I want to golf. You're giving me golf money," which was, maybe not exactly the normal thing you hear. But he said, "Fine, we're happy to happily give you golf money and go forth and sell this property." And his requirement on it, he said, "Well, this tenant's been really good to me. I don't want to screw the tenant over. I'm asking that you keep the tenant for at least a year." Which we said, "Well, I don't like all these different restrictions being put on it." But it made sense, and it was a good deal, and the numbers were right. So we decided to wholesale this one. Then we were wholesaling to landlord buyers. But the criteria was they had to promise to leave the tenant in place for a year, which was not an issue with some of our guys. We just put that out there to begin with and say, "Look, you need to leave this tenant in place for a year." And that sorted some people out, and they went away. But it kept the ones we wanted close by. And the guy that we sold to, his name's Dean, and he goes, "Well, I don't mind." He goes, "Because I might sell it in a year, and I would want long term capital gains anyway, right?" So he'd want to hold on to it for a year and a day. So what we did there was we kind of merged. We took the seller's concern, we agreed to it, we found a buyer that also agreed to it, and after a year fit his purposes anyway. So it's kind of my role as a rapid cash generator in the middle when you're negotiating with everybody is to find what are everyone's needs, what are their wants, what are their requirements, what do we need to put together, and then make sure we can make that happen for all the parties. So that's how we did it with that deal. And it was, you know, excellent renter. Obviously, he didn't need to put any money into it at the beginning because the same tenant was going to stay in there. So the same tenant was happy. And, you know, we just affected the sale in the background and everything was perfect.
Now, if that tenant had a lease and you're selling, the ownership is transferring, would that break the lease in many cases, or are you bound to the lease that the tenant might already have in place?
Well, we have the leases assigned over. So when I put something on the contract, I don't allow the existing owner to sign any new leases or extend any existing leases, but they agree that all leases are being assigned over to the new owner.
Mm-hmm. So you're bound to whatever terms were on the lease before you went into negotiations.
Correct. And in this case, it was interesting. As much as the guy wanted him in there for a year, the kid was on a month-to-month lease. So, I mean, it was kind of, you know, I know technically at our prerogative, but we had made a promise and we stick by it. And so we honored it through, we made sure it was honored through for another year.
So the negotiations then take you into the next step where you reach some sort of agreement, some sort of contract. What happens at that point?
Well, the goal of a good negotiation, the goal of a successful negotiation is the word yes, right? As soon as they say yes, then we've got to get it under contract. So, attorneys will tell you a contract is the meeting of the minds between two parties. And that's exactly what it is. I provide contracts in my system that are simple. They're easy to read. They're easy to understand. People can sit down at their kitchen table, you know, take 15, 20 minutes, read it, understand it, so they don't feel scared. And that's the next step is I put any specific terms that we've agreed to into that contract. The contract states that, you know, we're going to buy this property from you. We've got, you know, 30 days to do so. They sign it and we start the process.
So you have a proprietary contract that you've kind of put together with your lawyers?
I do, yes. So I worked with two lawyers to put together it's proprietary and it's simple. It's 4 pages long. If you think about your board contracts that all the agents use, they're usually pretty long and they've got a lot of very heavy technical legalese in there. And most of that, it's not protecting the buyer and it's not protecting the seller. It's protecting the broker and the board of brokers. So we were able to easily eliminate all that. And then I went to specifically sat with my attorneys and said, I wound up investing a lot in this contract over time because it's been worth it. But what do we have? What do we want to achieve? How do we want that to be? How do we protect ourselves first and foremost? We need to protect ourselves, get out of it if we need to get out of it. Make sure we're giving the seller what they need to get, and how do we control the buyer long-term as well? Because we are looking to assign the contract and move on. So we still need to maintain degrees of control. So between my 4-page pro-buyer contract and my 1-page assignment contract, I achieve all those goals.
And it sounds like your contract is written more in plain language that anyone can understand. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's one of the keys to it is, you know, I joke about a lot of complicated legal contracts. They might as well be written in Latin, you know, Greek. Nobody understands them. I sat down. I said, I wanted it to be as everyday talk as possible, you know, common words. The attorneys obviously always argue for very formalized language. And so we went back and forth on that and came up with a really good spot that's certainly favors the everyday language much more. It's still formal enough and has everything in there it needs to protect you. And if you ever wound up in a court of law, you'd be safe and the, you know, the judge would be comfortable with it. But at the same hand, it's really easy. It's easy to read and easy to digest. And that is what the sellers want. That's what property owners want. They want to be able to understand what they're getting into. In fact, I had a motivated seller of one of my students last week. The woman's name is April, my student. She said that it was so funny because the seller signed the contract and said, I understand it. I don't, you know, she said, do you have any questions? She goes, no, you answered all the questions in the contract. It's the first time I've ever been able to sit down and read a legal contract and understand it. And apparently, you know, the man's wife said, are you sure you get it? And he said, sit down and read it. It's so easy to read. It makes sense. I understand everything thoroughly. And therefore, I feel confident and comfortable moving ahead.
Yeah, it's rare that you find a contract that you can actually understand. I mean, you must have engaged in a lot of arm twisting with your attorneys to get them to write something so plainly.
Well, yes, I think that's part of the with apologies to any attorneys out there. I don't mean to kind of out you all on this, but there's I think that's done intentionally because then you're members of a club that understands something exclusive. Why are doctors writing prescriptions in Latin shorthand? It's so you, when you look at the paper, you don't understand what it is, but then magically the pharmacist does. I think that's kind of nonsense. So I wanted to shatter that and get in there with something somebody could understand. And yeah, there was some argument back and forth, but at the end of the day, I would remind my attorneys that, well, I'm the one paying you, so let's do it my way because that's what I want, and it's worked out very well.
So you've taken us from the beginning where you market to find the seller, you negotiate with the seller, get to the contract. What happens next?
Well, if I'm wholesaling, and that's still the case maybe 80% of the time for me, if I'm wholesaling, I shop around for a buyer. So I advertise the deal as I have it out to my buyers list. I've built a buyers list of rehabbers and landlords who are hungry for properties, and they pay cash for those properties because that's what I'm looking for. I want the no hassle, easy sale, and that's with a cash buyer. So I call my buyers list my ATM machine because when I go up and put a good deal into it, money comes spitting back out, and I like it that way. So I simply take the deal I have under contract, and I write a short blurb about it. I talk about, I give the address, a short description, my asking price, repair estimate, what the market rent is, what the current rent is. And I send that out to my ATM machine, my cash buyers list. And then those that are interested contact me back. And then, we talk on the phone. I send them pictures. We talk over email. I tell them to go see the property. And then the ones that are serious want it, make me offers. So they make me an offer on it. When I accept an offer, I clear out all the objections first, and then I accept an offer, and I send them my assignment contract, and that lets them take over my position in the existing sales contract and states how much they're paying me for that privilege.
Once you assign the contract, how do you hold that person you assigned it to the deal? In other words, are you taking a deposit? How do you make sure they're going to follow through?
Absolutely. Great question. Two ways. One is the legal paperwork they've signed. I don't stop marketing that deal until I have the signed contract with my buyer in place. And so they are legally committed to that contract because of the way I have it written. And they put my entire assignment fee into escrow. And so if that's, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, they're not going to let that disappear without thinking about it first. So they're going to go ahead with the contract because I've cleared all the objections out. They've signed and they've submitted the money. That's how I know they're going to proceed.
Okay, so you have their money in escrow. So if they back out, they don't get that money back.
Correct. And I don't take any of the money myself. I have them send it all into the settlement company, into the the settlement attorney or the escrow agent. That way, it's not like we want it, it's all controlled that way by the attorneys. And that way we know everything follows the letter of the law exactly. That's the way I like it.
Okay. So you're protected. You don't have to worry about them backing out because you've got their money in escrow.
Correct. And if for some bizarre reason they were to back out, I've got plan B, plan C, plan D, because there were other buyers that wanted it and I had to turn them down. So if somebody flakes, I would turn, I'd be able to liquidate their deposit and keep it. And then two, turn around and, call the second guy or gal that was disappointed that they didn't get the deal and say, hey, are you still interested? This one's come back to me. And then I would go ahead and go through the same process again with them.
So let's talk about your buyers and your buyer list. I imagine when you speak at the RPOA annual conference in February, you'll probably be talking about how you build that list and get some good buyers. But what is a healthy number for a buyer's list? And you're looking for people who can pay cash. What kind of cash do they have to have on hand to be on your buyer's list?
I don't stop building the buyer's list. I like to see people, you know, so I mean, the sky's the limit in terms of number, but when you're starting off, or if you don't have a buyer's list yet, I recommend you aim towards your first 100 names. And using the techniques that, you know, that I teach you in my rapid cash generator system, you can get 100 names in a month easy. Because there's just enough to, you know, you find enough people to go after. And the importance of having cash is multifaceted. You want them to be cash buyers because then they can say yes to your deal and move ahead with it without having to ask anybody else. There's no underwriting from a bank. There's no going to a hard money lender and having them say no, or going to their private money lenders and having their decision overruled when it's their own cash in the bank or their own line of credit. I mean, that's almost as good as cash. If they have full control over it, then when the person says yes, they can say yes and immediately tender the money into escrow, which to me, Brian, is a screening technique. Because if they start hemming and hawing about wanting to sign the contract or put the escrow money down, then I start to wonder, do they actually have the cash? And if they're not totally on board, what else is it about this deal that's bothering them? Because they said they liked it. But if they don't have the cash and they're not ready to go, so I use that as a screening technique rather than someone who's got to go, you know, go to a bank and wait a month and get an appraisal. And the kind of properties I deal with, they're usually run down and they need work, so they're below average. If you try to go to get bank financing, the banks, when the appraisal comes back marked as the property's below average, which no kidding, I want it to be, but that kills the bank financing, which is a little strange. And then as rental property owners know, when you start hitting, you know, depending on the bank and when, you start hitting between 4 and 10 mortgages, banks dry up and they don't want to fund you anymore because they wind up with different standards for that. So overall, you're safer sorting out your buyers for cash. And there are so many more cash buyers out there than people realize. There's a lot of people have a lot of money. They want to park it in the real estate. And they're anxious and nervous to get that money back by real estate. You just need to go find these people. And that's what I show you how to do.
What would your typical deal that you would offer, what kind of cash would a buyer need to come up with?
Well, if they're buying the whole thing out cash, that depends on the area. So, you know, in my area, those numbers can go very, very high. But we also have, we have some properties in the $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 range. Right up to the $700,000-$800,000 range. Either way, I'm looking for cash buyers.
Okay, so you might have a cash buyer who could pay $700,000-$800,000 cash for one of your properties.
Absolutely. And what I tell my students is just even if you don't believe that yet, go out there, build your cash buyers list. When you ask them to prove that they have the cash, you ask them for their bank statement. Or a line of credit statement, and you can have them black out the account number. That's fine, but you want to see their name on it and the amount of money available. You're going to be shocked what people are sitting on. Successful real estate investors have cash in the bank. They're sitting on cash, or they've liquidated other properties. They're looking to, you know, they're looking to trade up, and they've got all this cash ready to buy your properties. So it's a matter of just getting the right men and women on your list.
Yeah, and it's funny that if they have that cash in the bank, they're getting maybe, you know, less than 1%.
Yeah, they're getting nothing.
Yeah, so it's crazy. So what's the next step then? So you get the buyer, you assign the deal to them, you get their money in escrow. What happens next?
Navigating through all the pitfalls on the way to settlement. So you got to learn what to watch out for and things that can go wrong. You got to control your buyer. You got to keep in touch and control your seller. You've got to be in constant communication with the attorney, with the settlement office, make sure everything is good to go. And then usually something comes up with the title work. I mean, there's always something on the title work, even if it's minor. You facilitate anything the settlement company needs to clear out the title. So by facilitate, I mean talk to the seller, ask the seller for information on it, help that process along, because you can wait for them to do it, but they're not nearly as invested in getting that deal done as you are. So I always tell people be the consummate professional and the consummate professional make sure that they're asking for things, helping things along, facilitating anything that needs to be done. And then you get a settlement. You know, your buyer's inspected, your buyer's ready to go. When settlement day comes, either you're physically there at settlement or it's all being done remotely. I do things both ways. It depends. A lot of times I never meet my sellers if they live out of state, because one of the benefits of working with me is that they don't have to come to town. And that's convenient for them, but that means I never meet them live, but that's okay. But you know, we'll be at the settlement, make sure everything is smooth, make sure everything goes through. I review the settlement sheet in advance, make sure everything is correct for the seller, everything is correct for the buyer, and I make sure everything's correct for me, because the number of times my fee is left off of the settlement sheet accidentally seems to be happens so often, you wouldn't think it's accidental, but it's just one of those things that always seems to get missed. So my job as consummate professional managing a deal through the settlement is to make sure all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed.
Yeah, and you know, the title agents, they're professionals, but there's numbers that they'll miss all the time.
Well, yeah, and they're juggling a lot of different deals, and there's things. So it's they're excellent, they're awesome, but it's my job and my primary responsibility to manage my deal, to make sure everything's taken care of, to make sure there is no tarnish on my armor, because I am the knight in shining armor to this motivated seller, and I don't want my armor tarnished with them. I want them to be happy, because they're usually motivated because there's something wrong in their life, and so I want to make sure that I fix that for them, and I want to make sure I get paid, because that's how I fund my lifestyle and take care of my wife and my kids and reach my dreams and travel and do everything that I got into real estate investing to be able to do.
So I'm sure that you've had, you know, plenty of successes, you know, getting from A to B to Z in this wholesaling process. Do you have any examples of times when the deal is completely blown up for one reason or another? In other words, do you have any horror stories that you'd like to share?
Sure. I can think of two that are interesting stories for you. And one of them I'll tell quickly. I'm not going to use any names on this one due to the nature of the situation. But I had a buyer who was a very good buyer of mine. Meaning he had bought routinely from me. I usually sell him 3-4 deals a year, and everything always went very smooth. I had a rental property that was in an odd area of town, but I had gotten it under contract at a good price. But what was interesting was I didn't get a lot of my buyers interested, except for this one gentleman who buys from me frequently. He was very interested. And we signed a contract. He submitted the funds. Everything was fine. And about 2 days later, he calls me, and he's clearly in a panic, I mean, emotionally distraught at the point of tears. And I said, "What's wrong?" And he said his wife had just been diagnosed with a brain tumor, and she was 6 months pregnant with twins.
Oh, no.
Right? So I said, "Geez." He goes, "Look, there's no possible way I feel comfortable moving ahead with this right now. I'm just, my mind is all over the place." And all I said to him was, "Whoosh, whoosh." I said, "You hear that sound? I tore up the contract. Don't worry about it." And then I said, "And your money is being released back to you. Don't worry about it." And I lost that deal. I didn't lose any money on it, but he was my only interested buyer, strangely. And I shopped it around again, and nobody was interested. It was just too odd of an area, I suppose. And so I never made any money on that one. And the money was already basically in the bank, but it's okay to give it back when things like that. I mean, I think, you know, yes, we're in this to make good money and stuff, but I'm not out to hurt or destroy anyone. And certainly a situation like that is pretty awful. Hey, Brian, let me give you and all the listeners the happy ending to it. Fast forward a couple of years, the wife is fine, and the children were born, and they're beautiful. So it all ended well in that case. But he didn't need that trauma at the time. So that's one story. Well, you always have the option to do that. And again, the way I have my contracts written and the way my contracts are structured allowed me to do that. I mean, it was always my option to let him out of it. And then I didn't get hurt either, because I was able to get out of it with the seller because of the way I have my contract structured. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And you know, I'm glad to hear that everything worked out okay. And it's also good to know that your horror story doesn't end with you losing lots of money. You protected yourself.
Yes, which is the whole point of good contracts, and never don't screw around with the parts of the contract that are in there to protect you. And that's the other story I'm thinking of, where I did actually lose money. I lost $11,000, which was 1% of the purchase price. So it was I had a contract on a property for $1.1 million. It was a big property in a very hip and happening area, but the place had been run out, pretty run down and not nice. And my seller was an attorney, and I let him modify the various clauses of my contract. I mean, kind of clauses that I've worked hard to put in there, and clauses that I tell all my students, don't screw around with them. And I let him put a time limit on my clauses, my escape clauses. And what had happened was, when my buyer flaked out and I was stuck then with the property, and the only way out was to let my deposit go. And I normally never would have that much as a deposit. But again, I broke my own rules. I broke my own rules with the amount I had down as deposit money. And I broke my own rules with allowing someone else to fiddle with the protection clauses in my contract. And so I wound up, the only way out of it was when I wasn't able to proceed because no other buyers were interested. I was already past my time. I had to tell the seller to go away. And he said, "Well, no, you're going to move ahead with the property." I said, "No, read the contract. Actually, the only thing you're due is the escrow money, which was $11,000. Again, the happy ending on that one was the week I had to pay out the $11,000 there, I brought in $26,000 on a different deal. So I was still up for the week and happy. I mean, never happy to lose $11,000, but at least, you know, you certainly didn't go negative. It just washed the week wash some of the profits out for that week, let's say.
And after that experience, did you ever break your rules again?
I never break my own rules again. And I always tell that story and preach to my students and followers that don't break the rules that I'm giving you. Don't screw around with the contracts that I'm giving you. And that that story drives home why. And they get it. So the only time you break the rules is, again, if the guy's wife has a brain tumor and pregnant with twins, that's okay. You can bail out and you don't lose anything. But the moment you start to fiddle around with the very important clauses that I've built into my contracts, that's when you're going to get into trouble. So don't do it.
Yeah, or let a lawyer or some other supposed expert tell you that what you're doing is not what's going to work for them.
Correct. Well, if it doesn't work for them, that's their problem. Don't make it yours.
Good way of putting that. So when you're going to be speaking at our annual conference in February.
Yes.
February 24th, 2017 at 1 p.m.
My topic, Brian, is rapid cash generation. It's I want to teach people to go from spinning their wheels to doing more profitable deals. And I teach that in rapid cash generation, which is basically making money without money in real estate investing. Because the examples I've been talking you through today, I don't need bank financing. I don't need my own cash. I don't need much more than $100 to bond the contract with. And that's what I want to talk. That's what I'm going to talk about. That's what I'm going to teach people to do in February.
You know, I do want to keep some of that in suspense till then.
Sure. Then the only thing I'll add to that is I break it down into to three major categories. And that's find the deal, make the deal, and get paid. Find the deal is all about marketing. Make the deal is all about negotiation. And get paid is all about using the right legal contracts and then managing the deal through to settlement. And what's interesting, Brian, is if you think about it, whether you are a rental property owner, whether you are a rehabber, or whether you are strictly a wholesaler, you have to do those three things in that order no matter what. So if, let's say you're a landlord, you're a rental property owner, and you're not finding enough good properties to add to your portfolio, then you're going to love what I teach you in Find the Deal, because finding more deals is what you need to do. And you need to make better deals each and every time. Well, that is what making the deal is all about for the negotiation piece. So this hits all the different types of exit strategies and all the different flavors of investors that are out there.
Okay. Well, Tom, as we wrap it up, you know, I just want to say I'm looking forward to hearing you speak at the conference on February 24th, 1 p.m. 2017. Before you go, though, do you have any parting advice for real estate investors out there? Things that you would recommend they do or things that you might have done differently when you got started?
Sure. Yes. I mean, I find most people, whether from the rank newbie to the seasoned pro, we're all after the same thing. And that's we're after more deals, more profits, and more freedom. Freedom to do what it is that we want to do. Freedom to do the things that we got in the business to be able to do for ourselves, for our families, you know, for our hobbies. And until you get started, right, get educated, get started, get the ball in motion, and implement what it is that you're learning, nothing's going to happen. So the key always comes down to get moving, get in, implement, and go forward.
That is great advice. And I would just add to that if you want to get moving and you are in the West Michigan area, even if you're in Detroit, Chicago, Ohio, anywhere in Michigan, and you can make it to Grand Rapids on February 24th, 2017 to hear Tom speak, it's going to be well worth your time. We have other speakers who are going to be there. The conference is actually going Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. That's a great way to get moving. Tom, thanks so much for being on the show today and sharing all this great information.
My pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Rental Property Owner and Real Estate Investor Podcast, brought to you by the Rental Property Owner Association. You can find out more at rpoaonline.org. If you enjoyed this podcast, please go to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and review.